Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld. Upcoming is a discussion, a panel discussion from the UFO panel at the March 17th UFO discussion at the New Life Expo. On the panel is Ron Amatron, Jennifer Stein, the director of the Travis movie, Mark Brinkerhoff, Nathan Rosenblum, Peter Robbins, and Robert Morningstar. Hope you enjoy it. Stay tuned.
Okay. Oh, yes. Big applause for the UFO panel. Right. It is my favorite panel. Just a background about me. I think if you've had an experience, and I've had experience, I've had sightings, a possible abduction, who knows what that was, but it was something. You become obsessed with this subject. I mean, I have for the past 30 years, since, like, I think it was 87 that I really made contact. And you become obsessed. I was thinking about it last night. It's the way those kids that were in that school in Florida during the shooting, and they're so passionate about getting anti-gun legislation in place. It's because they were traumatized. It was because they were shocked. It blew their world apart. There they are sitting in a classroom, and suddenly there were, you know, automatic weapons being fired. Actually, I think if you're wanting to buy an automatic weapon, you have to qualify for mentally ill to begin with, you know. So, but besides that, that trauma motivated them to organize a huge march on Washington that's happening on March 24th. It was that sort of awakening that, I don't know if you can compare it to the UFO situation, but it was that for me. If you're walking around in your own little isolated paradigm and suddenly you see something that can't be explained. I saw one in New Mexico. I was out in Santa Fe, New Mexico. There was a light that appeared in the sky, and then that summer I was driving cross country, and then I was just like missing time in the middle of the night. I mean, I don't want to go on with my story, but I want to understand what's happening, and I don't think you can really understand it with the worldview that we are presently conditioned to think. So I've sought out all the UFO literature and people, Bud Hopkins, who Peter Robbins is going to be talking about later. I help host this event, Contact in the Desert, which I think is one of the finest in the country. Yes. 5,000 people like us gathering in a place to share experience and research and films and lectures. Anyway, it's very exciting. So there is this underground of a new culture emerging of people who are not willing to sit back and let the official authorities say that this is not true. You know, there's this movie, I Know What I Saw. And with the release of the New York Times article, everyone see, on December 16th, 2017, the Pentagon finally admitted, after 70 years of denial, that there is something they can't explain in the sky. That was a breakthrough moment, I think, for all of us. And we'll talk a little bit about that. So it's you can compare the people on this panel to, like, the Me Too campaign, sort of. Like, Me Too. I saw one too, and it was real. And the whole idea behind the Me Too campaign is that you cannot deny someone else's personal experience. We've had personal experiences that, no matter what the mainstream reality says is true, it's not me for me. There is no objective reality, in essence. Quantum physics shows us that. We're moving into a new paradigm of the subjective experience. So I may not go along with everything everyone says on the panel, but it's their experience, and I can't argue with that. So that's my little introduction. I'll introduce the people. Ron Amatron there. I don't know if I agree with everything Ron says, but it definitely has an experience, and we'll get back to that. And then Jennifer Stein over here, who just screened her movie, Travis, which is probably one of the best documented UFO, I wouldn't say quite abduction place, case, but it was, well, yes, it's a great movie about the truth behind one person, Travis Walton. Everyone know Travis Walton?
Yes.
It's an incredible case, being missing 5 days. It can't find him anywhere. He shows up on the side of the road. And unbelievable as it is, he says he was aboard a ship. I mean, I even have a hard time believing this because I've been so conditioned in the mainstream paradigm. But that's why I like to associate with people who help me believe in my own experience. Then we have Mark Brinkerhoff, who really is dedicated because of his experience. I mean, I was out at a picnic. I love to tell this story. And Mark says they're here. I said, they're not here. And he goes, look, right up there. And there was these little silver dots way up in the sky, way up in the sky. And I mean, how did he even know they were up there? But they were there. And he has lots of pictures and everything like that. So we'll get back to that story. And then my good friend, Peter Robbins, who... Yes. I love Peter's analysis of the UFO situation in the last 70 years because he brings a real intelligent, intellectual understanding of the phenomena mixed with his own personal experience. And we need that. And I think everyone on the panel brings an intelligent understanding of how to move into the future because this is about the future. And then we have next to Peter... Nathan Rosenblum. Thank you, Nathan. A real historian. I would say he combines metaphysics, spirituality, and ufology. So thank you so much for being here. And Robert Morningstar, our own very own Robert Morningstar, who may get into a little conspiracy, but nothing wrong with that, right? Nothing wrong with... Never heard...
There's only one big giant one.
Right. Okay.
One giant one is subset.
Subsets of conspiracies, so pick your conspiracy. And we'll start there then with Ron Abitron, because I think out of the panel here, Ron, you have a different take on your relationship to the alien phenomena. Do you mind explaining that? Let's start there.
Yeah, I started doing healing my whole life with people, and I kind of gave it up maybe middle 80s. I was too good with what I was doing. I had no repeat customers because I could fix something instantly. And they didn't know that they had a problem. So I had no comeback energy from people. And then I put up my website doing healings with people. And about two years after that, I started having alien interference. So here I'm working with somebody, and I go, oh, implant. And I go, I really didn't want to deal with aliens completely. You know, I wanted just to work with people. So what I am is a light being, okay, I'll describe that to you. I'm from source energy. My body is like a hologram here, and I go to source up and down continuously. So in your terminology, I would be a descended master and an ascended master at the same time. So I live here, I eat, I bleed and everything else, have problems, but my body is purified so I can go to source energy. And that's why I do instantaneous healings, because I live out of time. So you all live in time. And your time-based reality is on timelines. So when you think of a thought of something, you're on a timeline. And that timeline can be reproduced over and over again by the aliens. Like if you hurt yourself or you have an emotional problem, they can put you on, say, 500 timelines. That's all connected to your physical body here. And all timelines are real. All prophecies are real. All predictions are real. It just depends if you are on that particular timeline. So you following me so far?
I just don't want to have a metaphysical argument, but aren't we always existing on a spirit level beyond this time-space continuum?
Okay. No.
Okay, I think we do.
In source energy, you only have one life in the present moment. Being in time is where they take you out and you're living multidimensional lives. Mm-hmm. Okay, but in source energy, one life in the now. And there's no judgment in the now. And that's why I do the mind to heart drop for people so that you're able to connect to your own spirit in the present moment. So initially, the human body that we have here had your spirit with it, and your spirit was completely integrated with your body. So when you had a thought, that was your spirit talking to you throughout your whole body structure. Then the aliens came in and gave you mind energy. Maybe you got tired of living in peace, because source energy is peace, nothing else, no judgment. No timelines, no multidimensional lives. So they gave you all that stuff so you could be out there having your energy stolen from you. And that's where I got involved with the aliens, because I'm doing healings on people, and I go, oh, you got an implant here in your shoulder, let me take it out. then all of a sudden I'd feel the aliens coming in getting upset with me because I'm pulling out this implant out of somebody. So I had to put up a lot of stuff for aliens, and I got involved with the alien stuff. My first operation that I was doing with the military here was called the Gray Skies, and I have that on my website. The Gray Sky Energy was when the alien ships would come in here, and all the clouds that you see that are flat bottoms, those are alien ships. You probably know that already. I talk about this all the time, okay? Now, because they were coming in at such magnitude, they had to put up a gray sky hologram in front of that so that you couldn't see the alien ships. So I'm doing my BBS radio programs. I have over 2,000 archives on it. And all of a sudden, my room got filled up full of all these remote viewers. I probably had like 50 remote viewers coming into my room trying to figure out what, you know, the different governments, what the gray sky clearing is or what the militaries are doing. There's different levels of military, okay? So the ones in the service here know nothing about anything, okay? The more advanced militaries with their super soldiers, et cetera, that can pop out of thin air and go places, okay? Those are the ones that I deal with. And so I started enlisting people in the time-traveling soldiers. And that started maybe 5 years ago.
Oh, let's not go too deep. I don't want to lose people.
Okay. So the whole thing is that in the energy of the darkness, we'll call it, when you're not in the present moment, then you're on timelines, and the timelines are connected to the alien agenda, and that's when they steal your energy. Mm-hmm. So as far as myself battling them, yes, I've been in countless battles. I can't tell you how many, because they're coming in here trying to take away your free will, free choice. On this planet.
I hate to admit that I agree with some of that. No, but I do. No, I actually do agree with some of that.
So thank
you, Ron, for all your work. I hope you fed all those remote viewers that came to visit you when they showed up. Never mind. Jennifer, actually don't know your story. I know you've been involved, but I wonder how did you, because you're sort of a regular person out there, right?
Yes.
Normal existence.
Right.
What happened?
Yes, live in a very conservative community in Philadelphia, part of a Jewish community. Why the UFOs?
Yes, why?
A lot of people come up to me and, like, what happened? with respect to everyone on the panel, it's very nice to meet you. I don't have powers in any way, shape, or form like you do. But I did have an experience in 1995, the same year, actually, as Travis Walton's. And it stayed in my gray box.
1975. Right?
I'm sorry, 1975. Forgive me. Yes, I haven't had my morning coffee. My experience was with less than 500 feet, I saw a craft that was about 80 to 90 feet long, about 5 to 6 feet high, and it was a rectangle of undulating white light.
Where were you?
I was in my bedroom. It was about 5:30 in the morning in my parents' house where I grew up, and I was 19 years old. This did not make sense, and I didn't know what to do with it. It actually stayed in my gray box for about 25 years. A gray box meaning, well, maybe this happened, maybe this didn't. I had journaled it. I actually thought it was a dream. Until 25 years later, someone else who was in the house at the time with me, who had spent a year in a musical road show traveling with me, was sleeping on another floor of the house and saw the exact same thing. And we'd gotten together for a reunion in Hawaii. And we were cooking dinner and drinking wine and smoking cigarettes kind of thing. And he said to me, what happened when we had that UFO experience? And I dropped my glass of wine. I stepped about four, you know, steps back. I practically passed out against the kitchen wall. And I said, I don't know what you're talking about. I remember the me part of a story, but not the we part. And I said, don't even tell me. I said, you're scaring me. You write down your story, and I'll write down mine, and then we'll share, because I don't want you messing with my memory. And when I read his story, I realized that the experience was real, that it had happened. And at that point, it was 25 years later, I was like 45, and I said, okay, I'm going to step into this field and give myself permission to educate myself and go forward from there. Shortly after that, I went to a UFO conference, met Peter Robbins, who helped change my life. I got involved in MUFON. I'm a field investigator for the Mutual UFO Network in Philadelphia. And like I said, I live in a very mainline conservative area, so I started something called Mainline MUFON. and I host regular free educational programs at my public library. I'll be helping to run a national conference for the Mutual UFO Network in Philadelphia in July. I'm passing out flyers and inviting vendors to come. We have a great lineup of speakers. I got involved in meeting Travis Walton through Peter Robbins. I'm a filmmaker, so I ended up making a documentary film that's won about 29 mainstream film festival awards, which I'm very happy about. It's sort of a breakthrough film. Thank you. So I'm just trying to do my part as a responsible citizen, saying to people, yes, this is a reality. We need to begin to deal with it. It's better that we decide how we feel about it rather than having our story sold to us or told to us. I think we need to reclaim our own autonomy in this bizarre and odd genre and begin to be more public about it. And I think that December 16th is a beginning of a door opening to allow disclosure in a new way that the media may take a little more seriously in the future.
Thank you, Jennifer. So, Mark, thank you for being here. And I think a lot of people know your story, but I wonder where you are at and where the planet is at and where your people are at that you're in touch with at this point in our history. What's going, give us a little weather report update.
I've had a UFO experience since I was four. I was on board at 5 years old. And throughout different times in my early teens and into 20, and in England. And last actual encounter was August 10, 2015, in Central Park, of all places. Biggie just materialized, came over, talked with me, scanned me with a device, and he gets up and leaves, and I shook his hand and all, and he was real.
This huge. Is recently.
That was August 10th. He walks very slow, he was walking slow, because an Aetherian coming in from the dimension can not handle our dimension right away, but he told me it was first time coming in to come physical, so he's walking super slow to get, so I got up to follow him, because you know when you're meeting one of these beings, I at first thought, angel, but I've met angels. These ETs are similar to a look of an angel. Skin is smooth, not a wrinkle, not a flaw. Eyes a little larger than ours. And this being blue-eyed, very nice-looking kid. You know, I thought he was 24, you know, but the wisdom was beyond. Telepathic. And when he got up to leave, I actually had a camera with me, because everybody always says, well, don't you have a camera? I said, this time I did. So I went, like, to reach for it, and telepathically heard from my crew and friends, don't interrupt this energy. So I say, yeah, I don't normally do that, wouldn't do it. So he, when he left Central Park on 85th Street, going towards Central Park West,
right,
he just dematerialized. Okay. Now he walked past people with dogs, people with baby carriages, and nobody looked. The dogs didn't react, so I said, oh, I get it. They did the flag, they screen, so only you see them, even though they're physical when they come in. When he dematerialized, I was about to call Phyllis, my wife, on the phone to say, this just happened, and then I was told, look up there. And a UFO came out of the cloud. It was a few seconds after I took one shot of that picture of the UFO, when it engulfed with the heat and the warmth of love and the silence of light, nothing, no sign, it's all silent. No traffic and no dogs and dogs barking and kids swinging on swings or squeaking. And I said, oh, that's the familiar energy. So then I heard at that moment, don't wait too long before the next picture. Time goes by. You know. So I went, oh. And it was at that moment I was teleported on the ship. When I came back, it was 24 minutes later, I guess, or 25 minutes later. Everything that was around me in the park was now not there anymore, and people were leaving. The people that were picnicking are now leaving with babies. So I said, okay. Okay, but I felt fine. So I get home, and all the clocks are different. You know, mm-hmm. They kept telepathically saying, download the images off your camera. You know, Phyllis does that. She's the genius of the computer. So I said, okay. But we got delayed. We weren't able to do it for about a week. And Phyllis, when she downloads it, she goes, so why did you take a picture of a spaceship and wait 5 minutes later to take the next pictures? Because they were all in sequence. And I said, I didn't. 24 seconds. So they screened me at that moment until Phyllis said that. And then wham, everything came back in physical, total everything. They laughed because they wanted her to be with me, but it didn't happen. She
so
was
you
working.
Were on the ship for 24 minutes?
Yeah.
With your body.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I saw from their windows, they have amazing window type technology that's like zoomed in if you need to see anything on the ground, like anything. So
was there a message in that visit? I mean, something you got?
Well, I've been teleported before while I was driving a car mm-hmm. in 1976. And I got to I was going to a friend's house, Ralph, he's passed on now. And from where I was in Mahopac, New York, to where he lived was an hour away. And we had spoken on the phone at 10 after 11 p.m. And I said, okay, Ralph, if with good traffic, he's in the mountains, I'll get there by 12, probably. Mm-hmm. So I get in the car, I didn't have a clock in the car, but I got in the car, went to town through Mahopac by Lake Mahopac. We have a windy road around the lake, Dead Man's Curve, they call it, because it's sharp. You have to slow the car almost a stop to make the turn. I slowed it down, I blinked, and I was on the ship with my friends. I thought I was out there, because when I'm out there, I'm working like Ron. We come from the source frequencies, and our over parts are there. It's where it is now, and always now. And I was there. I was with my friends and family, we'll call them our friends. And I knew something was up, because they said telepathically, so how was your day? They said, day? Oh, I never got to Ralph. I said, who's driving the car? I said, what happened? Who's driving the car? They said, everything's suspended. Don't worry about it. Oh. It's okay. And they said, we'll see you tonight on the fields, and we'll see you tonight when you're up here, out soul travel, we call it. And I said, okay. I blinked, and I was in the car. But the car was like hovering. It was like levitated. I was aimed at the woods near Ralph's house, because he's up on the mountain. You have to make it left. So I slowly turned the car left, and I felt a connection. I got to Ralph's driveway, I pulled in, I beep, beep, like I always do. Light comes on. He says, Mark, how can you be here? I said, what do you mean? I said, I was just on a spaceship. I said, they got me around Lake Mahopac. He says, Mark, I just talked to you. I just hung up the phone with you a few minutes ago. I went, well, that's impossible. He says, well, come look at the clock in the kitchen. So we got in, his father was watching TV. I got in, his father goes, how can you be here? Mm-hmm. I said, what's the clock? It was 5 minutes.
It
was... roughly 5 minutes, because I got in the car 10 after 11. It was now about, well, if anybody knows me, I ramble around getting my bag and my stuff out of the car. So by the time I got into Ralph's house to see the clock, it was already about 3 or 4 minutes more. So it was about 20 after 11, roughly.
So you were teleported and in time and space.
But this is the reason that these things are happening, to let us know we can be helped and rescued, and they can take us out off the planet when needed.
Right.
But, and here's the big part, you have to purify, you have to detox, you have to not be engrossed in drugs and smoking and alcohol. You have to cleanse. You can't be lots of pornography, because I can see it in the energy fields. They cannot be into this earthbound pleasure energy with the negative demonic-y type of creatures that are here too. Because where do you think they were cast when they were cast mm-hmm. down in these frequencies of lower density? And this place.
We have to raise the frequency, and that includes...
keeping your thoughts on Creator, the light.
Even like things like gossiping and cursing, and that lowers your vibration. And so, but, they seem to have an insertion point. They can, like in a film, they stop the film, they insert their time sequence, and then, it's just like that. They're able to cut and splice time, these ETs.
Oh, yeah, they're time traveling all the time. We want to know that but we all can have these experiences any time.
Thank you, Mark, for sharing a personal experience. Peter, what I want to ask you particularly is, we have people with lots of experience, and, of course, people you've worked with Bud Hopkins, really the godfather of UFO abductions. But is it possible to make sense of it all, from your perspective, from the whole analysis of everything we've seen and will be seeing? We could put it into a new box, but how do we connect all these dots? How do we make it into another evolved worldview? How do you make sense of it all? Mark's story, Ron's, all of it. Or can we not make sense of it at the level of consciousness we're at? What do you think?
At the level of consciousness I'm at, I can't. I'm an investigative writer specializing in the subject of UFOs, and before I try to address your question, briefly how I became involved in the subject. I was born in New York City, but my sisters and I grew up in a little village on Long Island. In the 1960s, I had what I would describe as a fairly happy, innocent childhood, about as sophisticated as Leave It to Beaver, And as a very nerdy, geeky little kid, I excelled in the arts, and I set my sights on being a painter, which was what I became. But at that time, on one particular afternoon, my sister Helen and I were goofing around on the front lawn, as kids do. It was a late morning in June, not a cloud in the sky, and one of those days in villages where there's nobody going by, no other kids playing. And I caught something out of my right peripheral vision and looked up in time to see five silvery white disc-shaped objects coming in at a high rate of speed and stopping over the neighbor's house. And I either said, look, or called my sister's name, and we were quiet for a prolonged period of time as we looked at them. There was nothing ambiguous about them. They were each ellipses, like a dinner plate at a slight angle. They were in a very precise V formation, like military planes might fly. But there was no question. They were round, and they were close enough that we could see that they were metallic, not shiny like stainless steel, but like brushed aluminum maybe, and also close enough that we could make out regular detailing around the edge of each that, for lack of a better comparison, would be like seeing an airliner close enough to see windows on it. It went on for several minutes, which is a tremendously long period of time, and we didn't say a word. In that time, I tried to process what I was seeing. All I wanted at that moment in my life was to be a popular kid, to have nice clothes, to be about a foot taller, to have good hair. You know the routine. And although I had never given the subject any thought, I grew up in a culture where, of course, I knew about flying saucers. I'd see them in the movies sometimes on Saturday when I'd go to the fantasy theater with my little friends. But I was also intuitive enough to pick up the adult world message that, yes, they're real in the movies. But there they were. No wings, no sound, no tail. And I started to go through a reaction that I've encountered in hundreds of interviews with people, experiencers, people who have had sightings over the decades, which I've come to call the checklist reaction, where you look at some variation on this, and your rational mind goes, not planes, kites, blimps, balloons, helicopters, strange-shaped clouds, birds, flotsam and jetsam reflections from the ground. Oh my God, what am I looking at? It was tremendously intimidating to me, and not only went against everything I thought I knew, but I realized if I talked about it, my friends would make fun of me, because that was the culture. That is the culture, to a great degree. And hard as it is to imagine in a way, although it happens in the case of much more conventional trauma all the time, I put it out of my mind. I joke with people sometimes and I say, if I have another repressed memory, I don't remember it. But this stayed nice and tight and locked down, and nothing shook it loose over the decades. Jump ahead more than 14 years. I'm a painter at the Loft in Chinatown, starting to show my work, working in Soho as a construction worker on a lot of the factory buildings, teaching painting at the School of Visual Arts one night a week. And a combination of factors that I think I understood brought this memory up, and in no uncertain terms. All of a sudden, it was like a movie loop running through my mind, that whole thing. And I got very upset. I thought I was going crazy, realized that I wasn't. But then, I mean, how can you forget something like this? It challenged me tremendously. And after having a real little breakdown in my little loft, I, you know, took a had a cup of tea, washed my face, and thought, I need to verify this in some way, and there's only one way to do it. My sister at the time lived a mile or so north of me, aspiring poet in the East Village, and I gave her a call and says, it's a good time to talk. I had thought this out beforehand. What I knew I didn't want to do was say, I just remembered something from childhood. This is what I remembered. Do you remember it? Knowing that she would say yes or no, because then I'd never really know. So I said, I just want to set the scene and see if it brings up anything. Beautiful late spring, early summer morning, No clouds in the sky. We were playing near Mom's rock garden in the front of the house. You were about 6 feet to my left. And she stopped me mid-sentence and basically confirmed what I had remembered. And in that moment, I had a kind of a split reaction, essentially, oh, my God, they're real. Oh, my God, they're real. And then she said, but there's more, and I don't know how you're going to feel about it. And then proceeded to tell me in detail fragments of her memories of being aboard a craft. And this was 1975, interestingly, big year, when she's telling me this. And I had never heard anything like this. You could not be alive as a young person in the culture and not have heard of Betty and Barney Hill. But that was pretty much the extent of it. And now, after years, decades of working with Bud, doing my own investigations, traveling the world on this subject, I've heard not only variations on what my sister told me hundreds of times, I've heard it word for word. People say, oh, my life changed overnight. No, mine didn't. Mine changed in about 60 seconds. What happened to my sister? What was the phenomena? And I became so obsessed with it that my only dream in life to be an artist, and I don't mean like a painter somewhere in my little house selling things in a flea market. I mean a major international artist working and living in New York City was eclipsed by this, and I resented it tremendously. I still do in a way. I don't love this work. I do it because it's important, because I've grown pretty good at doing my corner of the work. My interest is less at this point in my life in them, where they come from, you know, the different races and planets, as much as people who are affected by it. I'm very much a humanist. I follow in the steps of one of my major mentors, but I'm very much a nuts and bolts person. I had three mentors in this work, the best known being a painter who went on to international fame as kind of the father of scientific abduction studies, named Bud Hopkins. Your question.
Right.
And again, how do we sort of tie this?
Yeah, how do we make sense now at this point in our history?
Well, I guess the best way I can encapsulate it is go back to December 16th. Yeah. We now know, on that day, the New York Times carried a series, well, two articles, on the UFO phenomenon. And for a lot of people, it was a very big deal. The main article, you could say it was a first-page article, even though it was a tiny little box on the first page and continued inside. But as somebody, probably one of the few people in the world that has read every single article the New York Times has ever published on the subject of UFOs, and reread them and reread them, it's about 225 articles. I'd say about 97% of them are condescending, sarcastic, belittling, pseudoscientific, dismissive, and this was not. If you read it, you will see the New York Times never says, oh my God, UFOs are real, we believe them. Here's the report, and it should be noted that two of the three writers that wrote it were already involved in the subject, one deeply involved, the great Leslie Kane, who wrote a remarkable book some years ago called, I think, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Talk About UFOs. And Leslie is an actual journalist. She's not a self-trained investigative writer like me, and had a very distinguished history as a journalist by the time we connected in the early 2000s when she had written an article for the Boston Globe on the famous French military UFO report, Comitas, I think is the way it's pronounced. I was running a UFO-related news service at the time. I got the article that morning. I called her and ultimately introduced her to Bud, and she became very involved in the field. She is not actively involved in it now, but she is still a force to be reckoned with. Ralph Blumenthal, who has also written for the Times on UFOs, again, regulation issue, first world, straight journalist, but I think because of their insights, their connections, this thing made front page. Anyway, what it basically says is X number of years ago, A committee was secretly funded to the tune of $20 or $22 million, with major support from a very well-known American senator, and this study went on. There was a companion article, which was an account of two flyers, military flyers, who had had an experience that, I won't say countless, but probably hundreds of flyers in air wings of their military around the world have had. Unknown, scramble, go get it. What, again, made the Times article's coverage different was that at no point did they get smarmy or sarcastic. That's a huge breakthrough for the Times. However, the following Sunday, the big Sunday Times, there was an editorial by a staff writer, Ross Duault, writes regularly for the Sunday Times. I'd characterize him as an intelligent, thoughtful, archetypical liberal, very much in his head, often on the money with his subjects. But I started to read it, and I thought I was reading one of the original editorials from 1947. The entire tone of the article was, oh, we live in a sophisticated world, and we have a lot of sophisticated stuff up there. Everybody's longing for, you know, somebody to save us. It's a lovely thought, but get real, folks. You know, the Martians aren't real. We're alone in the universe, and this is a little distracting, but I think it's wonderful in our culture, blah, 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 that people are free to think these thoughts. I think the most important thing that came out of it, and the most important thing that any of us can do or look for, is anything that will help cut through the ridicule factor. In the summer of 1947, there was a phenomenally effective program. It was essentially the child of the major media, and at the time that was the newspapers with some radio coverage.
This was after Roswell, right?
Yeah, Roswell and the Kenneth Arnold sightings. Every day the American people were slammed away with the understanding that all of these sightings that were starting to come in from around the world were war jitters, still hadn't gotten over World War II, anxiety about the new threat, the Soviets on the horizon, that we had rockets that we were testing, that the Soviets had secret rockets they were testing. People were seeing these things. And, of course, everybody remembers what happened on October 30th, 1938, with Orson Welles' War of the World. They still trot this out. And in a way, it's still worthwhile. There was a certain amount of panic. However, the ridicule factor became endemic in this culture and stuck and became worldwide. And before I chew up everybody's time, I just want to say that over the past 8 or 10 years or so, one of the things I've noticed as a regular speaker at conferences here and abroad is more and more, there is a demographic, and I'll say most of them are in their 50s to their 70s, who now, you know, are out there at conferences more than younger people. They're interested, they take it seriously. The point being, every year, more and more people in our culture care less and less what other people think about what they think about this subject. Mm-hmm. And that is phenomenally important. And every time any one of you in this room, who wouldn't 10 years ago have said to a colleague or a relative or a friend, went to this conference, you know, there really is something to this, you ought to look into it. And they say, whoa, you know, Joe or Bill or Margaret, they take this seriously and they talk about it. Maybe there's something to it. That's important. That's something we should all be trying to foster in our own daily lives.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter. For me, this, I'm not bored with this. I mean, this is the most exciting thing happening on planet Earth. This is our future. And I mean, what else is there? You're going to talk about the same old wars or the same old corporate greed. This phenomena, whatever it is taking us into the future. And I think if more of us come out for the truth, for the government disclosure in a big way, we're going to have a renaissance of humanity that we've never seen before on this planet. So, yeah, it's very exciting for me. But Nathan, you're a real historian on the subject, going back to ancient civilizations. Do you want to introduce how you got into it and what's happening? Yes.
Yes.
Nathan Rosenblum.
My interest in the subject comes from, first of all, my own... since I was a child, I have always been understood that I did have a certain clairvoyant abilities in this regard to perceive extraterrestrials and spirit beings. And I always understood all of these being connected. Of course, we see this in terms of the socio-political aspects, but also, to my mind, the spiritual aspects have always been very significant and connected to my esoteric understanding of the nature of existence. And this is very significant because when we talk about the level of consciousness of people throughout the world to extraterrestrial involvement, there are a number of other factors that are not as widely known even in the ufological community as a whole, but that are very significant in this regard and have, in some cases, a massive following. For example, one example of this involvement with extraterrestrials that has been very notable, and this not is worldwide, is in the Pentecostal churches. The Pentecostal churches, you know, are some of the largest growing Christian denominations worldwide in Africa, Latin America. And for many, many decades, there has been a discussion of UFOs in these groups very openly. This actually began even before the 1950s, but in the 1950s, some of the more popular Pentecostal evangelists were talking about these things. For example, one of the most important American Pentecostal ministers was William Branham. Now, Branham, he said openly that he was best known for his healings, and that he said that extraterrestrials were working through them, and this was in the 1950s, where he was talking about this. And he explained that people actually did, sometimes he actually pointed out UFOs that were near the churches where he was preaching, and he preached across the United States and also in many other countries.
But doesn't that come with the religiosity placed on top of the UFO subject? I'm just curious.
Not necessarily. Branham said that there was actually quite a bit of controversy with him because, and some of the Pentecostals explained that they had been having contact since the 1930s. And they explained that they actually, some of their views, there was a great deal of controversy with other churches at this time, but even their aspects of their theology were very much affected by this. As they explained, there are actually even photos of Branham online. He had huge numbers of his sermons were all recorded via audio and are available online. There are photos of him with, in his aura, you actually see a glowing golden halo over him in photos of him. And there were many others, O.T. Jaggers, who wrote a whole book called Flying Saucers about his experience with them. So, and these Pentecostal churches throughout the world, there's a real awareness of this, and more of them are actually talking about the extraterrestrial involvement in their work. And this is something that's very interesting. In the largest Pentecostal denomination in the United States is the Assembly of God, you know. And people who have gone to them, and there have been some ministers who said that if people go to these churches, especially if women wear, you know, some covering over their head, like St. Paul mentions in his epistles, they actually, for some reason, it has to do with the way the chakras are either open or blocked slightly, so allows them to, certain clairvoyance to become more apparent. But when the women have covered their heads in these Pentecostal services, and some men also, they have actually seen entities, extraterrestrial and interdimensional entities, working with the people there and standing behind the people at times.
Is this because the Pentecostals also have this altered state they go into
sometimes?
That's right.
That's right. And that's one of the things that just as we see with the, you know, fire walking in with Hindus in India. So in the snake-handling Pentecostal churches, I once heard of a Pentecostal church many years ago that used a blowtorch and the members were unharmed by the flames of it. So you have many examples of that. Another area, again, that's not as well known, perhaps to some areas of the public, but that also does talk about UFOs greatly, is many Islamic groups in different parts of the world. These are connected to the idea of the jinn, which are talked about in the Quran and other sources. And many Islamic teachers are both Sunni and Shia, have been talking about UFOs and such. In some cases, very openly, such as by the Saudi government has even sponsored conferences on some of these aspects. But there are also aspects of the spiritual awareness and the of interdimensional travel and even extraterrestrial bases that are, and these are also talked about in Pentecost groups. In Africa, for example, they are very much aware of these things, and these are being taught in the churches and the mosques, including Sufi groups are very much involved now. And these things are not as widely well-known in the general ufological community, but we can see how this consciousness, which I consider very significant, has been expanding.
Well, also the Native American cultures acknowledge the existence.
Oh, yes, that has been very important. And that has, again, been more talked about, especially many of these traditionally were kept only to the initiates of the particular group. But more and more over the decades, that has been released. They feel that it is the time for that, so we can see this level of consciousness throughout the world is expanding and through many different formats and in different arenas.
So it's just really the Western materialistic paradigm that excludes anything else except itself, in a way.
To you could say that, yes. But like I say, and more that has really been breaking down many areas very quickly now.
What was the first time you realized this was real? For you.
The truth is, for me, even as a child, I had an understanding. I can remember, when I was like 3 or 4 years old, I had images that I was seeing of what looked like, I thought, little people and other beings. I remember had sorts of, I thought I saw faces looking in at me. I didn't know it, or others watching me. And I sometimes had difficulty in defining precisely what I was seeing. But now I realize I was experiencing spiritual and extraterrestrial. And some of my early drawings I have from the time I was, in preschool and early elementary school, they include, extraterrestrials and other things.
That actually reminds me of my memory of being 3 years old and remembering faces looking through the window.
Yes.
So that I think this is why we have these discussions, so it can stimulate memories that may have been buried in all of us. I mean, if you're in this audience today, something is pushing on your subconscious mind to say, what else? What happened to me? Thank you, Nathan. Robert Morningstar, ladies and gentlemen.
Hello, folks. Thank you for coming today. I'm Robert Morningstar. I am the editor of 2 UFO periodicals. UFO Digest is the principal UFO publication I'm involved with. But I have another one on WordPress called the UFO Spotlight. And the reason for that one is that somebody has been repeatedly hacking the UFO Digest website, marring articles that I've published by famous writers like John Lash. I recommend the work of John Lash to anyone who wishes to understand the spiritual aspects of one aspect of extraterrestrials are not benevolent, and they are predatory. They're like leeches.
Are these the Archons?
The Archons is a good name, a good term for them. He also sometimes associates the Archons with the Anunnaki, who are the founders, basically, of our worldview and have manipulated the paradigm that they imposed over the centuries, over the millennia. They have modified that paradigm and changed it according to the culture that they wish to manipulate. Yes, so I believe that all religions on this planet are ET established.
I just want to say the Archons kind of go along with what Ron was saying. When we disconnected from pure spirit, the Archon mindset created this monkey mind aspect that separated ourselves from our spirit. So we have this in-between filter that is imposed on us, and I think that is an ET phenomena.
The other thing is that we are not strictly earthlings. We are not strictly earthlings. We are also moonlings. And none of us would be here today if the moon had not arrived in Earth's experience. We would not have a concept of time such as we have with 12 months of the year, 28-day period cycle. Women are very tuned into that. And all of this has been part of a psycho-spiritual engineering project that has been going on to elevate basically monkey men and monkey women to a higher status of consciousness.
So the moon was pulled into place by some extraterrestrial race?
I believe the moon is alien, not of this world. There are,
Was placed there, right?
It came. And we became a dual planet system, really. The moon is so much larger in proportion to the Earth than any other moons that we see in proportion to their home planets, that we really should consider us a double planet system. And this moon has had a tremendous effect on us. Aristotle believed that when we died, our souls went to the moon to be repackaged for reincarnation. That it was in the moon that we drank the waters of Lethe, the waters of forgetfulness, so we would not remember our previous incarnations when we came down. So, you know, Aristotle is the father of science. So that was his first theory of the purpose.
So what's happening on the moon?
On the moon. I brought some photographs here, which I'm working on a DVD. I'm going to release my collection of Apollo photographs and enhancements. This is a photo of lunar ruins. Now, you talk to NASA, and they'll say those are collapsed lava domes or some kind of hogwash explanation. NASA has been hiding the facts about the moon for as long as they've been looking at the moon. And this photograph, I cherish. This photograph was taken by a Russian Luna satellite that was one of the first photographs of the far side of the moon. This is a very high-resolution photograph. And the reason I love this photograph is that it provided me the information I need to prove that NASA has been lying to all of us about the correct structure, the terrain of the moon. NASA flattens out all the mares. It makes them look uniformly homogeneous. The fact is that these two dark spots up here, these two dark spots, they're on the far side of the moon. One is called the Mare Smythe.
Yes. On the dark side of the moon?
It's far side, technically. Yeah, okay. We used to call it dark, but the sun shines there too. What these show is that these openings, and that's what they are half as deep as they are wide. Let me just say.
But what is the significance of these holes?
These are entrances into the lunar interior. When the Apollo astronauts were sent to the moon, they were told to look for entrances into the interior, which we knew already from other sources existed.
Is the moon hollow?
The moon is hollow in certain regions, and the moon rings like a bell. When each Apollo mission, when it left the moon, took the lander after they got back into the command capsule, they took the lander and crashed it. After having set seismographic instruments, the moon rang from 3 to 6 to 8 hours, depending on which region the crash occurred. So this means that it is hollow, and it has tintinnabulation. It rings on and on, and it took a long time for these to dampen. The third photograph shows you that the moon has an atmosphere. The atmosphere of the moon is very thin, and it has a lot of particulate matter, a lot of glass.
What do you think the atmosphere of the moon is? What's in the atmosphere?
Well, the atmosphere of the moon is very interesting. I have found photographs and films that show that certain regions of the moon are exuding. It's still partly volcanic, and there are craters which exude gases on the far side of the moon. We don't say dark side anymore because.
Okay, yeah.
But it sounds cool because I love the album.
Right.
Anyway, but on the far side of the moon, there is an area of great interest to me called the Mare Orientale, and it's the deepest crater in the moon. And this crater is so deep that you could fit Mount Fuji in it and still have thousands of feet above it. The Chinese have been doing tremendous work on the moon, and I would point you to ufodigest.com. Right now, I have an article there. I published it last year as the most spectacular TLP, transient lunar phenomenon, that has ever been captured by human cameras. And it is that a huge UFO approached the Chinese lunar lander, and it came down like this. I mean, it is resplendent. It is magnificent. It is rainbow colored. And it happened on Christmas Eve of 2013.
And there are pictures of this.
Oh, I have 10 photographs. Now, here's the cool thing. Totally dark moon, Christmas Eve, silent night on the moon. The shadows of the rocks on these first photographs are going from the left to the right. Sun is here, rubble on the ground, shadows are long, and they are from the object to the right. All of a sudden, this UFO appears like this at a 45-degree angle. And there are three photographs of each set. This is amazing. Three photographs. It comes in like this, comes in like this, comes in like this. Next three photographs in front, like this. Third photograph, now we're up to the seventh photograph. Here, here, here. The tenth photograph, it's not in the picture. It's not in the picture. But the shadows on the ground are going from the object to the left. This thing was so bright that it changed the shadows on the lorraine. We call it terrain on Earth, lorraine on the moon. So this is a very big thing. I think that the Chinese have made contact with extraterrestrials on the moon. This is the name of the title of the article. UFODigest.com. Have the Chinese made contact with ETs on the moon?
Right.
And I believe they have.
There's also the book, Who Built the Moon?
Who Built the Moon? It's a wonderful book.
Yeah.
I
don't know who.
Chatelaine.
But also, for people who don't know.
Maurice Chatelaine.
The moon, I'm sure you know, the moon only has one side that we see on the Earth, so it sort of rotates as it revolves,
right.
Which I don't think there's another object in the solar system that does that.
No.
So, and also what's so strange is, seen from Earth, the moon and the sun are pretty much the same size. That's why eclipses occur. And the chances of that happening accidentally are ridiculous. I mean, it just doesn't happen. So I think the moon was put there in place to clean our atmosphere. You know how it pulls on the tides of the ocean? Well, it pulls on the tides of our atmosphere even more, because it's the gravity of the moon can pull atmosphere easier than water. It
pulls on the tides of our brains.
Right, lunatics, right. But,
yeah.
But
I'm sticking with lunacy.
But, you know, the Anunnaki, or whoever you want to call the Archons, they were sort of a negative group, but the people who built the moon, whoever they were a positive force. So how do you reconcile the two?
Well, we have our guardian angels. We have a group of extraterrestrials that cares very deeply about us. They are our guardians. And for every malevolent race, every attempt of a malevolent race to misguide us, to kind of cast us into a materialistic prison, there is the spiritual element, our guardian angels, our angels, my archangels, and they protect me. I've had my own extraterrestrial encounters. Memories that are suppressed. The alien has the ability not to make you forget, but to force you not to remember. It's a very subtle thing. One is the idea that you experience something and you're made to forget it. They have a drug or some...
I wouldn't say it's a drug. It's some kind of mind manipulation.
Richard Dolan thinks it's a drug. Okay, so it's something that suppresses the memory from being recorded in your conscious memory. However, the insult to your body, we have something called somatic memory. And when your body is abused, and I think that abductions are abuse, the body remembers, and the soul records the memory. And
it's traumatic.
It is traumatic.
I mean,
and the trauma,
PTSD.
The trauma can upwell and bring the memory back.
But it also may be suppressed because they don't want people to freak out and, you know, go crazy, because if you really have these experiences, like a lot of people do.
What are they doing that would make us crazy?
That's well, they're doing a lot of stuff. But I do want to, I mean, there's been a lot of negative press about the ETs, but they also appear over nuclear silos, nuclear missile silos, and disconnect that nuclear activation. There's been lots of cases of that at lots of the disclosure conferences. You can see that. Sure. And they also appeared in New Mexico. I mean, the Roswell thing wasn't far from where the first atomic bomb was dropped. So there is a positive aspect to the alien presence.